Welcome to episode 2 of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week we have Tim Walton from Delex Consulting and president of the Center for International Maritime Security, Annie George. Tim, I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure, Matt. Thank you. Like to consider myself a friend of the podcast and happy to be here on the show. I'm definitely not as qualified as some of the other guests you've had, but
we've only had one.
Okay.
So you're sort of mid. You're good. You're still on the mean plane.
Okay. Happy to be here. I currently work for a defense consultancy called Delex Systems, based out of Herndon, Virginia, and we do requirement studies and ConOps development. We also help a number of commercial and international partners with capture strategy shaping. Been working on this for the last several years, and I've worked under the direction of Mr. Brian McGrath.
Yeah, so you're already on the inside. We all know Brian McGrath does a lot of writing on defense and strategy, and you've been on the think tank side. Guys like me, Director Scott, and our president, Annie George, we're all sort of operational people on the surface warfare side, and our podcast guest last week, Doyle Hodges, he's just retired from the Navy, and he was on that operational side as well with a little bit more of the strategy, so it's nice to have somebody here that has more of that strategy experience. So this week's topic was Strategic September. We started off really well. We had an article called On Stockdale and Strategy by Lieutenant McLaughlin, and his big point, and I think the big point for all of us at this point, is what is American strategy. Not so much what is our means and what are our ways, but what's our ends. And I guess what he went through and he did is he asked several different people what our strategy was, what our ends were, and he got 9 different answers from 9 different people. I guess I'll throw this to you, Tim. Tim, you're on the inside to a point. You know, you do the think tank realm, and that's really where they come up with these grand schemes and bullet points. So from your perspective, what would you say the ends of American strategy is? And then we can break into more of the means and where we should go from there.
Sure. Now, I'd certainly caveat this by saying that I definitely haven't done any formal strategy development for the Department of Defense, but I've assisted in some think tank efforts, some efforts for the Romney campaign. And as I see it, I think America's strategy has at least 3 enduring ends. The first is maintenance of access to different points throughout the world, both economic and political. That access allows our liberal, democratic trade order to prosper. And as a maritime nation, it gives us the ability to grow throughout the world. The second, perhaps, is the maintenance of a favorable balance of power in regions throughout the world. The U.S. learned very well in the Second World War, in particular, that it really couldn't stand back as an isolationist power, and it had to be engaged throughout the world as an active player in order to maintain a favorable balance of power in the Western Pacific, in the Near East, that was conducive to ensuring that no hegemon would arise. Threats of that hegemon throughout different periods have been Japan, the Soviet Union, and now the specter of China in East Asia and Iran in the Middle East loom.
Now, if I can jump in on your second point, I know you have one more. When you say guarantee no hegemon would arise, would you say that's more as other powers arise, we try to make sure that they're invested in the American system? Or do you think it is an active, this power is rising, we think it's unfriendly, we're going to prevent it from expanding? Because I would say at least that those are 2 very separate things.
I think they definitely are. I think to date, the U.S. has observed that these hegemonic powers, namely Japan and the Empire of Japan and Soviet Union, had aggressive aims, and so we explicitly tried to oppose their expansion, militaristic expansion, and balance their efforts, sometimes through military action, other times through political support to more friendly regimes.
Let me refocus my question. My question, I guess, is more of an economic and political sense. In the modern time, understood, Cold War, World War II, very explicit circumstances where the United States is opposed to a hegemon. Would you say that model is the same for China? Because there's not a lot of, I would say, legitimate things or internationally legitimate actions the United States could take for a power the size of China today to oppose their political or economic expansion through trade or through international organizations like the UN, because they are already so heavily invested. How do you sort of see that dilemma? Do you think that relationship has changed? Do you think we're quietly still trying to do that Cold War containment style? It's just more difficult. Has the end changed, or is our means just more difficult to pursue?
I think in general terms, it's important to really, as Americans, to push back against the sometimes sort of this fallacious notion that the U.S. has opposed the rise of China. I think on the contrary, the U.S. has been the single greatest force that has advanced the growth of the People's Republic of China, from politically its integration into the U.N. Security Council to economically. At the end of the day, the U.S. has supported the growth of China's economy throughout the late 70s, 80s, 90s, has encouraged the integration of China into the World Trade Organization, and has been the largest consumer of Chinese goods to date. So the U.S. has pretty much at every stop sought to encourage the growth and the economic prosperity of the Chinese people, consistent with our sort of benevolent approach in the world. We've sought to encourage the rise of China as a responsible stakeholder in international affairs, as Robert Zoellick stated it. This has sought to integrate China in a number of multilateral institutions throughout the world, in the UN, the World Trade Organization, in communications unions and the like. There is a question, though, now, I think, of whether that approach has ultimately been successful. Throughout the 90s, I think there was the dominant discourse envisioned that U.S. Economic integration of China into sort of the global liberal trade order would result in political reform within China, more towards democratic order, and would also result in an economy in China that was more open to the sort of the playing of international companies and the like. Although the latter has happened to a certain extent, I think it's very clear that there hasn't been any significant political reform from the 90s. On the contrary, sort of most scholars, I think, would argue that conditions are worse now politically within China and are more conservative and oppressive now than they were in the past. And then at the global scale, when we look at what China's intent really is, I think there are concerns by our partners and allies in the region that China really has a revisionistic approach towards stability in East Asia.
So what you would say then is that our strategy up to this point has almost been the construction of our own Trojan horse. So we've tied them into all these organizations. We've given them all these access. We've given them quite an amount of legitimacy in an effort to, in sort of the way that a father will give someone an allowance so that they'll learn the importance of money on a grand scale, not to, of course, seem pedantic by my analogy, but is that we've attempted to say, hey, this is a brand new power. Here, we're giving you these responsibilities. We're making you part of these programs. And rather than forming China into the model that we would like to see them, it's rather given them an opportunity to push and protect their model that they have.
I think there are some points to your characterization of the situation that definitely makes sense. I don't think Trojan horse is an apt description.
Maybe it's a bit too aggressive. It's not really.
Yeah. So instead, I would see that the U.S. sort of historically has had sort of positive intentions, but the U.S., sort of the third pillar of our strategy, I think, has been the promotion of democracy and universal values throughout the world. And that's reflected in our China policy.
So this is just to remind everyone, this is to go back to, these are your three ends, and we're going back to your third end, and that's the promotion of democracy.
Correct, and universal values. And that's sometimes done more assertively, more enthusiastically than other times. With China, I think we've been delicately trying to shape the environment in the region. President Clinton in 1996, I believe, termed that he sought a democratic evolution in the People's Republic of China. And the whole process of economically integrating China and politically integrating China into the international community has been one that, that seeks to, at the end, I think originally, make China a more responsible stakeholder, and originally perhaps even sought to induce a level of regime change within the communist regime in China. More recently, here in, over the last 10 years, that language of regime change has really evaporated from discourse in the region. Instead, there's more of a contentment, or at least there's no challenging of the status quo in the communist regime in the People's Republic of China. And this is indicative in for cases such as the U.S. role in Taiwan, People's Republic of China relations, Republic of China, People's Republic of China relations, where I think the U.S. has definitely taken a sort of a step back in its role, and it is not as strongly encouraging democratic reform within China. And personally, I think that's something that needs to change. It's one of our strongest values that we have as a nation. It's something that our partners and allies greatly appreciate. And I think we can respectfully yet firmly assert our belief in democratic norms and values and encourage the Chinese to peacefully adopt them.
Now, I guess looking at that, so let's talk about that third pillar. We're talking about promotion of democracy and universal values. You and I were talking earlier today, actually, about the white paper, Sustaining U.S. Global Leadership, Priorities for the 21st Century, and the SCMR, which came later to revise that due to sequestration. And how do you think, with sequestration, if sequestration continues, how do you think promotion of democracy and universal values, how do you think that will continue? Will it continue? And further for our discussion, just to keep in mind, we were talking as well about the Middle East and Asia. It noted those two points as being the sort of the 2 feet where we plant our policy. And your thoughts on that third point, promotion of democracy and universal values, it seems like perhaps the United States has a better chance of encouraging more improvement rather than in the Middle East, but let's say in Africa, since we've noticed that several attempts from the Arab Spring to today have failed at multiple points in the Middle East to encourage more democratic values, or rather to do so without bloodshed. I'd get your thoughts on that.
I'd say that, that the general aim of promotion of democracy and universal values is more in the purview of the Department of State, Department of Treasury, Commerce, other governmental institutions other than the Department of Defense in the United States. But over the last decade, our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq has made it so that the Department of Defense really has been in the lead in many ways in terms of the promotion of democracy in the region. I think that needs to change from both budgetary reasons, but also because I think historically the Department of State and sort of U.S. values, cultures that are brought through our economic interaction throughout with other countries have been the best ambassadors of sort of those democratic values and norms throughout the world. So it's my hope, and I think this will be seen more, that the U.S. I don't think will be taking as enthusiastic a role in militarily intervening in countries to promote democracy, let's say. But that's not to say that the U.S. shouldn't stand as strongly behind the promotion of that democracy or those universal values or the promotion of human rights throughout the world. And I think that's certainly going to continue. To your point on the defense strategic guidance and the number of missions enumerated, we could just quickly run through some of them.
Sure, go ahead.
The defense strategic guidance in 2012 lists the primary missions of the U.S. Armed Forces as counterterrorism and irregular warfare, deter and defeat aggression, project power despite anti-access area denial challenges, counter weapons of mass destruction, operate effectively in cyberspace and space, maintain a safe, secure, and effective nuclear deterrent, defend the homeland and support to civil authorities, provide a stabilizing presence, conduct stability and counterinsurgency operations, and conduct humanitarian, disaster relief, and other operations. So it's a long list of missions.
Wouldn't you say, too, almost that, and I think this is what we were kind of getting to at the beginning, is if you put out a document like, do you see a unifying concept there? Does American strategy in the strategic guidance, does it have a unifying concept? Do you think there's something in there that we could pull out? Because you remember back in the past, mutually assured destruction, or we, like in the Navy, we use the term freedom of the seas a lot. There are some pretty clear ideas that exist. You give a list like that, do everything all the time for everyone almost. Do you see sort of a unifying thread in there, or do you think that we really need to go back to the disciplined process of trying to find what is our real strategy?
Yeah, that's a good point, absolutely. I'd say that the unifying thought, perhaps, of the Defense Strategic Guidance was that the U.S. is going to maintain a global emphasis, but it's going to emphasize the Asia-Pacific and the Middle East while ensuring commitments and partnerships in other regions. So it had a regional emphasis, let's say. Did it have a mission-oriented focus? Perhaps less so. And it's difficult. As you ask yourself, which one of those 11 or so missions wouldn't you do? It's hard to really have an answer.
It's almost a truism. It says the military will conduct military operations. Well,
more or less, yeah.
Thank you, yes.
But I guess the details come in the scale of the operation and how many budgetary or what level of budgetary resources you're going to allocate to each one of those missions. I think certainly the ability for the U.S. to project power despite anti-access area denial challenges is going to feature prominently. It did feature prominently in the Defense Strategic Guidance, and it's going to play an even more important role as new strategies are examined post-strategic choices and management review, as the U.S. realizes that it's going to really need to focus on a select number of missions. The unfortunate flip side of that is that there'll be some other missions that'll be underemphasized in other geographic regions, particularly Latin America. Others used to say Africa, although the sort of the intensity of violence that we've seen over the last few months perhaps makes the argument that we really can't ignore that as much, or we're going to have to play a more active role in that region as well. But the U.S. is going to have to be more creative, but at the end of the day, perhaps do less in certain areas.
Where would you say those areas are?
Where the United States will
should do less. I'm saying, I guess we'll break it into two points. We'll say where you think we will do less and where you think we should do less. Sort of break that into two.
I think ideally the U.S. wouldn't do less in many of these
places. That's true.
But given this is a strategy and we have to balance.
Yeah. You have to prioritize some
ways and means. Specifically, I'd say the emphasis does need to be on the Asia Pacific, as that's going to be the locus of economic growth and prosperity in the 21st century. So the U.S. needs to balance that region because that's where the money is, and that's where the opportunity for our country moving forward, I think, will primarily be. The areas that I think are going to receive less attention moving forward will be Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East, perhaps.
See, I find that, and I 100% agree with you, that's probably where we're going to make the cuts. But to me, that's almost bizarre because you look at Asia and you say, all right, Asia, we talked about the economic tigers, but that's been happening for so long. We all know about decreasing returns. And you look at Asia and you say, well, okay, how long can you boom for? Yes, you've got Burma. Burma's just opened up. Now you've got that regime is improving. They've got reforms. It's allowing the West to break into the market. China's breaking into the market. But a lot of those economies have already been open. And I look at something like Africa and I say, okay, I get it. right now, Africa is not the biggest concern, but if you look at mineral resources, specifically rare earth minerals, you look at innovation, like, for example, mobile banking in Somalia. By necessity, you can't have a physical bank in Somalia unless you want to be constantly robbed or destroyed in a war. Is you've got these innovations, you've got these people trying to break out, and you've got such a low level of economic development that when you talk about growth or where the next market's going to be, I mean, that to me is Africa. But of course, I'm a big fan, so that's. I'm always
with what you're saying. I guess the distinction is the level of military involvement and how involved the Department of Defense will be in some of these regions, I think, might diminish. But whether the U.S. broader sort of national enterprise needs to more closely engage Latin America and Africa is certainly a very good question. At the start of the Bush administration, George W. Bush, he had proclaimed that Latin America was going to be the focus of his administration. We were incredibly close to the region, united by the Western Hemisphere, and there was incredible economic potential that we're now seeing in places such as Colombia, Mexico, and Brazil in the region that the U.S. wanted to be able to continue to tap into.
You remember Admiral Stavridis's comments on that. I was rather impressed when an admiral came out and said that his AOR was, in fact, not requiring more funds. That was really interesting. My first introduction to him when I read that is to say that South America didn't need more. And I think this was during the Bush administration. I could Google it, but that would be cheating. The point was is that he didn't need more funding, and he actually thought it far more appropriate to give the funding to USAID or the State Department or the people building the diplomatic relations. And from what I've from people I've talked to and with Riverine operations and what have you, is that the South Americans, especially in the case of the Colombians, they're already very deft militarily. So when it comes to how much assistance you need to give them, it's actually minimal. And then you have cases like Venezuela, where you wouldn't want to give it to them anyways.
Agreed.
But about last 10 minutes here, because I know you have to go, thoughts on the Navy. We've been talking a lot about general strategy. The SCMR, when it came out, Secretary Hagel, his big statement was we're either going to have a bigger, lower-tech force or we're going to have a smaller, high-tech force, and gave those as the two options. Then you had Brian McGrath came out, and he actually talked about those two as well as the two different options. And almost some people have brought up the idea that they're not really options. It's more of a warning. Where do you think that we're going with the Navy? Where do you think we should go? And let's say sequestration continues. What's our path forward?
Maybe I'll start with the last point first. I think if sequestration continues, at least as laid out by the Strategic Choices and Management Review, we're going to see the number of Navy carrier groups, for example, shrink from 11 to as low as 8. We'll see, I think it's very clear, a Navy of 232, 250 ships in the next couple decades, significant reduction of the force. We'll see a decline in operational readiness of the force. We'll see a decline in the modernization of the force moving forward. I think overall it'd be disastrous for the force moving forward. Whether this budgetary environment will compel certain changes that will in force design, force structure that might ameliorate some of those losses remains to be seen. But I think in general, if you have less, it's not going to spur innovation necessarily. It just means you have less, and hopefully there are people that make the best of the situation mm-hmm. and think smartly. As to the question of Navy strategy moving forward, for now, in general terms, the Navy has a two-hub strategy focused on the sort of Asia Pacific and then the Indian Ocean, Middle East region. There was discussion in the Romney campaign that I had the honor of helping out a bit with on whether the United States needed a three-hub strategy in which there was increased emphasis on naval presence in the Mediterranean Ocean. I think that the recent events over the last number of months have sort of shown with the Arab Spring, the civil war now in Syria, and the resurgent Russian presence in the Mediterranean has shown that, that maybe that argument has merit.
Definitely had some water to it, yeah.
Yeah. The difficulty will be the amount of funding and whether that's a realistic strategy. Are we going to really be able to do that? Do we have to maintain a two-hub strategy or maybe even switch to a one-and-a-half hub, let's say, focusing on the Asia-Pacific with some forces in the Middle East region? It's a difficult scenario moving forward. I guess the best way to make of it is that we need a clear strategy. Don't know if the quadrennial defense review will provide that, but even at other levels, the U.S. needs a new sort of strategy for the Asia-Pacific, for example. The last East Asia strategy review, for example, took place in 1998.
That's true, and a lot has changed. A lot has changed since then.
Which is incredible, and we've had a number of other sort of interim planning documents since then, but a new strategy review that more explicitly lays out the U.S. vision and how it's going to accomplish that vision for the Asia-Pacific region, I think, is definitely due, especially given our current fiscal challenges. Many of our partners and allies are asking us that you've spoken of this rebalance to the Asia Pacific, but what are the details going to be of this? We've seen some naval forces move into the region, Marines to Australia, LCS to Singapore, and some other developments. But looking at the U.S. strategy to the region politically, economically, culturally, militarily, I think is definitely due. And on the military side, I think Secretary of Defense Hagel certainly needs to encourage his staff to proactively develop an East Asia strategy review now in 2013-2014. Secretary Hagel's chief of staff, for example, is Mark Leiber. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia, and he's intimately acquainted with the region. And I'm sure if the secretary asked Mr. Leiber to execute, he could certainly lead an effort to explore this and to develop a suitable strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes... I'm actually rather surprised. I did not know there was no in-depth study into Asian security issues up until this point, because, I mean, that's rather shocking considering the amount that we've dealt with it.
Absolutely. If I can build off of that...
Sure, go ahead.
Part of the sort of the back and forth has been seen in the Senate, where Senator McCain in particular has held up the relocation of a good number of Marines from Okinawa to Guam as planned. And specifically, they've held up the funding for this relocation. The argument, I think, in general terms has been there's no strategy and there's no clear explanation of how the precise role that those Marines will play in Guam and in the Northern Marianas. And so he's been holding up the funding to actually start the construction necessary to execute that and the
like. Well, isn't another issue that Senator Hank Johnson, I think he brought up, that if we put too many Marines on the island of Guam, it also might flip over. I was rather shocked. I didn't know that was a thing that happened, but hey.
That was also raised in Congress. No, that's true. It's my hope specific to the Guam issue that there's the NEPA process, the National Environmental Protection Act review process that's taking place now, and it won't be finished until 2015. So this master plan for Guam, let's say, can't be finished until then. It's my hope, though, that the Senate will recognize that there are a number of interim steps that can be taken and funding can be sort of released so that the construction can take place before the East Asia strategy review will be kicked off. But going back to the earlier point, I think it's definitely in Secretary Hagel's court to start that review once more.
True. Well, I know you have to get going here, but so everybody knows, this is a friend of the podcast, Tim Walton. I don't know if you have anything that you want to plug as a Twitter feed or a website or what have you. It makes us feel more official that we plug things, being a podcast. You don't have Twitter. Do you have Twitter? I think I can't remember.
I have a Twitter.
You do?
You can find me there. I don't use it very often, but...
maybe you should use it more often.
Only thing I would plug is that our company's website is delex.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can search for it on Google as Delex CSA. And if you have any sort of need for assistance, happy to help.
All right.
Thank you very much for having me, Matt.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was Tim Walton. We will be back after the short break with Annie George. She is a president of the Center for International Maritime Security. And we'll go over some articles this week, talk about the QDR, and continue our discussion on strategy issues. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, before we join Annie George, president of the Center for International Maritime Security, since we're talking about strategy and people in the know, or rather people of vague or middling, or in the case of my little sister, no intelligence, knowing what American national strategy is, I have my sister with me. She is studying math and stats at Rice University, so she's no slouch. So my question for you, Lauren, being a smart, relatively speaking, but not more than your bigger brother question, is what is America's naval strategy?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
Zero idea.
Come up with one. Oh, okay, what do you think we do on a daily basis? Or better yet, why do we do anything?
I mean, yeah, but I do not know anything about naval strategy.
Well, you watch the news, right? You must have some idea of something that we do.
Matt, I think you're like...
This is so perfect. You have no idea. This is exactly what I was hoping would happen. You've set everything up. That's perfect.
All right.
Do you have any closing remarks? Do you have a Twitter that you would like to... That you would...
No, I do not.
You're not
do not follow me on Twitter.
Okay, so then no one ever has to communicate with you ever. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks, Lauren.
No problem.
But I am here with Annie George, the president of SIMSEC. Welcome, Annie.
Hello, Matt. Thanks.
And what we're going to go here is we just heard from my sister, Annie. You got to hear her. And our question now is not only the issue of strategy, what's our strategy, but how do we get people to understand and give value to what we do? And I thought, and two interesting pieces to better focus our strategy were Commander Salamander and Richards that were on, well, how do we actually do a QDR? And one suggestion was that we get rid of the QDR, and the other suggestion was that, hey, let's have a parallel process, and maybe we'll get something more cohesive out of it that hopefully in the end people will understand. And I guess, Annie, being the president of an organization whose direction is to get people to talk about and think about strategy, what do you think our strategy is? And I guess, how do you think is a good way to word it to people so they understand? So it's not a 27-point idea like, hey, there's the 18,000 things that we do.
Well, I mean, I think the first... you know, the first portion of it is make it readable. You know, I come from a soundbite world. My background is marketing and communications, and I'm a writer. And kind of the first rule of writing is if you want to communicate with your readers, make it understandable. And if you look at strategy documents that we have before, you know, like past QDRs, the SCMR, you know, they're really dense. And even if you look at, you know, 21st century sea power, also really dense. So just making it understandable to a wider audience, I think would do, you know, great things for the Navy, but for the military in general. I mean, just listening to your sister, you know, we hear, you know, here in the Navy world, you know, I can give you, you know, a few, you know, little tidbits of what maybe the Navy is doing in the world and what our strategy is. But, you know, just, you know, not being able to come up with anything says we need to do a better job.
Probably, because the one thing that I was thinking of, and I was talking to Tim right after the previous section ended, and my thought was that, hey, if we don't understand it totally, the person who doesn't understand it, yeah, they say, hey, I support the troops, which is great, but in regards to what? Like, if they don't think the troops have a job, or they don't think that the troops are necessary, then they're not going to be able to support us the way that we want to. Like, yeah, hey, thanks for opening the USO, but I could use a new ship, and I need funding for a shipyard period for these 18 vessels, and then they'll turn around and say, hey, man, I don't understand why it is that you need this, not because it's their job to. it's not their job to, it's we're supposed to communicate it to them, and I don't think we do a good job of doing that.
That's the thing that I think is really nice about Commander Salamander's blog post was, you know, kind of what I kind of got out of it was, you know, you can't write a strategy that people will get behind with a laser pointer. And what I mean by that is, you know, kind of the older generation, you know, he kind of set a few quota points, like 50%, you know, less than, you know, whatever age. But you need folks that are in the fight, and maybe if they're not writing the strategy, they're at least reviewing it. I think that was a really good point, you know, from getting policy across.
It's probably too something that's going to happen to all of us. Is the older you get, the more steeped you get into a certain mode of communication. And even if at your heyday it made sense, now it's, you know, some other generation has moved in and they have a different way of thinking and communicating, and you're still talking in terms of the Cold War conflict that you were fighting, or Desert Storm, or what have you. But the thought, as you kind of looked at what we've written, and you just became president during our recent elections, what do you think as an organization, I guess, what is our strategy? Let's talk about SimSec. What would you say our strategy is?
I think I'll talk in broad brushstrokes. You know, if you want to talk about core competencies, which I kind of think of as, you know, what's the mission of SimSec, and why, you know, why were we established a year and a half ago by Scott? You know, our core competencies are creating a conversation. And, you know, we don't take positions on issues. We foster the conversation around issues. And, you know, just a few bullet points to back that up. You know, over the last month, 30 days, you know, we've had 31 blog posts. And, you know, SimSec, I should know the number off of the top of my head, but I want to say somewhere around 150 folks, you know, make up our membership roles. And look at the topics that we covered just in 31 blog posts, you know, Polish strategy, Stockdale on leadership, Stockdale and strategy, Syria, the QDR, content delivery networks, you know, the Russian Ukrainian arms, and German security. And that's like, that doesn't even, you know, scratch the surface of the topics we've covered so far. So, and all of this is part of, you know, fostering that whole conversation. So I think that's why SimSec's here. And that's why, you know, I think that's why we've been so successful in the past year and a half. You know, we've built a really good community, and we're not having issues getting content going. So it's, we're in a good spot, and I think we'll keep going.
Yeah, that's been a particularly painful thing for me. Yeah, it's like, hey, you're the director of the Next Board blog. I'm like, great. And now it's like all this material and people. It's a lot easier just to be the writer. You're like, yeah, I'm going to have some thoughts. And here, you go post it on this blog over here. And now it's like, well, here's 20 blog posts. Please edit them and go through them. And, oh, please put my pictures in. And then you're like, ah, crap, man, I could go to sleep now, or I could properly format photos into this blog post about Indonesia, and you're like, well, crap, it's my job. I can't put on a business card if I don't do it.
Well, it's 12:12 right now in the morning, so you know, I'd say we're along those lines.
That's true, but I have to be fair. I'm on leave, but I would probably have done. Maybe I'll give myself credit. I would have done it anyways. But just on that point, maybe we can talk about this. We have two more weeks coming up. We have the African Navy's Week, which is coming up next week.
Well, you know, the first thing I would say for African Navies Week is that I hope somebody defines Africa.
That's not fair.
I think
you
might be a little bit behind on Skype feed. But...
What's
that?
It looks like we are. Okay. Anyways, yeah, no, keep going into that. You're bringing up the completely unfair topic that I didn't define Africa in regards to African Navy's Week.
Well, but maybe it's not, you know, maybe that's an interesting post that we get. You know, I was talking with a few of my active duty friends who declined to be named for the purposes of this podcast. And, you know, we were talking about the upcoming African Navy's Week, and they said, well, you know, the first thing we really need to think about is define Africa. And while that's not a specifically maritime strategy question, it plays into an important part of, you know, how the Navy relates to Africa as a whole and how we develop that strategy. You know, there's so many, you know, religious fissures, governmental tenancy fissures, that it's a really interesting part of that equation. For Sacred Cow Week, I just hope we get some really good articles.
Or irritating, you know, ones. Sure, that would be fun.
I'm sure we all have the sacred cows of the Navy, or just strategy in general, that we'd like to see struck down, or at least, you know, discussed. So I think that'll be a good week for us.
Yeah, and I think this is a good point. It's 12:15 at night to cut ourselves off. I don't want to keep you too long. I know you just flew back to D.C. Would you drive back to D.C. or fly?
I drove.
Okay, you drove to D.C., and within 10 minutes of you arriving in D.C., I flew out of D.C., and you have work. I'm on leave, but I appreciate it. Do you have a Twitter feed, or do you just want to go with the SimSec feed?
Well, there's the SimSec feed, but if you would like to follow me on Twitter, it's at MyPenDigs.
MyPenDigs. Is that two Gs? Because I know there's, like, weird.
It's edit. Just one G. It's like the phrase, MyPenDigs. I'm a lit major, and so it's from a Seamus Haney poem. Well, may he rest in peace.
I am security studies major and don't know what that has anything to do with. You can follow me at AmericaHipple. And you can follow SimSec at SimSec and find us at www.simsec.org. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, Annie.
Thanks, Matt.